Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Three Prong Podcast. We're now in Series 2 and going from strength to strength. And tonight, we also have a very special guest that many of you will know in the meat industry, Mr. Norman Bagley. But first, we'll start off with our usual intro, which is the good, bad, and the ugly of our week. So, boys, who is going to take the good this week?
I'll take the good. My good is that hog roast season is in full swing, and we've got our biggest event yet this coming weekend in London. It's a back-to-back sort of festivals or festival to Saturday and Sunday. The logistics of coming back to the farm to pick up a pig and wash a machine are going to be interesting, but yeah, I'm excited to do this one. Nervous, but excited as well.
Cool. What sort of festival is
it? Flav, what are the major sort of issues with hog roasting? Is it a hard thing to get into?
I think, well, the biggest bit, if you're not a pig farmer, is sourcing decent pigs, but we've got pigs, so that's quite handy. But I'd say the biggest issue, especially if you're doing a public event, is judging the number of people you're going to be serving. So a lot of ours are private, so you get told the number beforehand. We get paid 2 weeks before the event, so that side's all sorted. Whereas when you do a public one, people, you might take a whole pig, you serve 50 people, and then you got all that left over. And then also the challenges of keeping the pig, because ideally with EHO, after 2 hours, you don't really want to be having the meat just there. So it's to trying to time it and doing it at peak time where people come queue up, you serve, and you're gone. So it'd be interesting.
Well, I'll take the bad. I think being an Englishman, I think there's only one way, one place to go with this. Obviously, last weekend, yet again, we fell agonisingly short. Got to the final despite playing some of the worst football in the entire tournament. But anyways, we got there. But yeah, just to be disappointed once again. It was a really tough night. I'm unfortunate enough to have a lot of Scottish friends, and I really dished it out when they went home very early. So it really came back to bite me. So yeah, I was tail between my legs for a few days as well there.
Yeah, it was. You're right. They did play crap and they lost to a better team, so they didn't feel overly gutted, to be honest.
Yeah,
it is one of those. So I'm taking the ugly. I don't know if you can call it really ugly, but there's always been a bit of a slang and a bit of a thing around BMW drivers. The BMW drivers were always classed to be the people that were, don't have indicators. Well, I've learned in the last month or two, they've been replaced by Tesla drivers. These people who drive Teslas, I do not know. Like, I'm going to go and get a Tesla, and then I'm going to bore you. I'm going to drive it like a BMW. And the next thing I'll do, I'm going to bore you about how many kilowatts a mile it does, its charging rate. Let's talk about charging stations. I mean, who would go and buy a Tesla and just shout about it? Because unless you got given one, you just keep your mouth shut.
You're just jealous, Neil.
I'm not jealous. I drive around with a 3-litre V6. I ain't ever driving an electric car.
Yeah, I'll wave as he has a pass you then.
So much of his electric car that he let me drive him up in my diesel to Turnberry.
Was he worried they didn't have a socket there or something like that to plug it in?
I was called in to my sort of this old-fashioned diesel thing.
Well, actually, I said I might pass Neil, but I probably don't think I'd pass Norman the way he drives, to be honest.
Oh, happy days.
So enough of the Tesla banter. So yeah, as we said, we're honoured tonight to have a very special guest in Norman Bagley. So Norman will be very well known to many of you in the meat industry that listen. He's a former auctioneer, an avid tweeter, and most recently he's founder and head of policy of AIMS, which is the Association of Independent Meat Supplier. And as he mentioned, an avid golfer and, but I must say, a complete bandit. So welcome, Norman. And tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Yeah, so I was an auctioneer until foot and mouth in 2001. Latterly, for the last 20 years, I've been ripping in North Yorkshire. We had about 70 wholesaling abattoir customers in Ripon. It was a really successful farm-owned market. And for the last few years of it, I got very interested in the regulatory controls which were increasing on abattoirs. And along came foot and mouth, so the auction mart was closed. But before that, I'd been on a task force on meat inspection charges with Colin McLean, who you might remember, used to be CEO at MLC in those days. And this task force was very influential in the end because we won the principle of a headed charge system of chargeable inspection. And it saved the industry a lot of money. And it actually alighted to the fact that about 50% of the total throughput in meat plants, in red meat plants, went through medium and smaller abattoirs, which obviously hadn't been the political message of the previous 10, 15 years, which the smaller, medium-sized guys didn't add up to much. So I set up the organization on the 21st of February 2001, which is literally the night before foot and mouth. So I ended up with 50 operators. In those days, smaller operators. We set the organization up, and the next day, foot and mouth broke. And so we were right in the front of it. And foot and mouth did us a real favor in terms of the organization, because over the ensuing 6 or 8 months, 12 months, the medium and smaller plants were the keys of getting stuff dead, because a lot of the big plants were closed because they were the wrong side of control areas and all that sort of other stuff. So by the end of foot and mouth, we ended up with 80 members, and now we've got about 300 members in total, which amounts to about 130 or 40, 50 abattoirs, 100 processing plants, catering butchers, and then 50 service providers, and all other added value members. We've moved very much from just the small and medium size to embracing the big ones as well. We're in white meat. We look after about 2/3 of the poultry industry, as well as red meat. And essentially, the reason that the membership of our organization is attractive is that we have a really fantastic technical and legal team. I've got 5 vets that work for me, 2 of which are ex-chief vets of the FSA. I've got 1 who's a farmer and a barrister, as well as being a vet. 2 other guys that were connected into the FSA. And a lot of people wonder why you would need that sort of team, but the meat industry is the most highly regulated industry in the UK. Relative to risk, it's total nonsense, but that's how it is. And if you're supplying a major retailer, the biggest risk you've got as a processor is that there's a animal welfare expose or one of the farms that you buy off or whatever. And the retailer will, of course, be in the firing line there. And the reputational risk is extremely high. So what we do is we get in the way of all that stuff, because you've got animal activists that are illegally entering plants and all that. So all of that crisis management has to be coordinated and done in a very, very sensible but pragmatic way. And no other organization has that sort of team. I think most of them thought that, well, they've all got technical teams, haven't they? So these big guys, so it doesn't really matter. with technical teams are one thing, dealing with welfare exposés, activist interventions, and all these sorts of things. That's what we deal with. Now, we deal with all the rest of the regulatory requirements. We deal with the politics, we deal with everything. But principally, it's looking after meat plants with regard to issues on the ground, you know, your day-to-day operations. You know, running a meat plant is a highly complex operation, and you need that support. So we're there pretty well as a one-stop shop for running a meat plant. That's how it runs.
Sounds good.
So, does that give you a flavour?
It does. So you're very much dealing with almost like not the farmer part, but the looking after what happens when the animal leaves the farm and the sort of food manufacturing, almost like the food and manufacturing part of it. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes. Yeah. So obviously the farmer customer base is vital to the well-being of the processing industry. You haven't got farmers, you haven't got any processing. So managing the relationship between the farmers and the processors, you know, that's very much a commercial operation. But we try to help encourage good working practices between the two on that. So we engage a lot with AHDB and the other levy boards that farmers rely on to represent their interests in, you know, in marketing and exports and etc. But yes, you're right. Essentially, we're looking after the meat processors.
With regards to the welfare side, Norman, I remember sitting in a meeting with Red Tractor regarding sort of welfare and pigs, and it's quite clear, I find, when the welfare talk is spoken, at least at farm level and probably a little bit at abattoir level, it gets to a point where cost comes in. And for me, as a farmer, I always think that if we care so much about an animal's welfare, then to a point we shouldn't be putting cost ahead of the animal's welfare. And a sticking point for me is like the use of gas, like CO2, for stunning for pigs. And I think like there has been talk of potentially using inert gases or mixing in inert gases to make it probably a bit more less stressful for the animal. But then you hear the talk of, oh, it's going to cost too much, or it's not going to be as quick if we use electric, or electric is not as accurate. But do you think there's going to be a time where there will be that push from within the industry rather than from outside, i.e. activists and having expose videos put out of pigs holding their breath or whatever? Do you think there'll ever be a time when the industry will think, okay, actually using CO2 probably isn't the best gas to use, and let's invest a little bit and use, whether it's in like argon or whatever other gas you're going to use? Because if it meant that I paid an extra 10p or whatever for the animal to be killed with a gas that's better than CO2, I think I would do it. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
So gas stunning from a welfare point of view is quite a contentious area.
Mm.
There's arguments, you know, there's arguments for and against, which I get.
Yeah.
The traditional way of slaughtering has its critics as well, obviously with the electrical stunning. But a lot of the large operators have gone to gas stunning, as you know. And it's not just efficiency. You know, as far as they're concerned, the science backs up what they're doing. But it's a bit like non-stunning, isn't it? You know, you've got the whole science of cut to death, you know, times as well. So the issue of stunning per se, non-stunning, gas, is just such a fluid area of discussion. You've got the religious elements of it, and not obviously in pigs, but you've got the religious element of slaughter as well. So the whole area around methods of slaughter is highly debated, highly contentious, difficult politically. So in pure terms of the whether the current system of gas stunning is the best, I think I'm probably with you in that technology being what it is, it's not unlikely that in the near future that a different form of gas stunning comes forward and says, by the way, we can do it better than this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I don't think the authorities, because of the international use of it, are likely to turn around and ban gas stunning. Because they can rely on various veterinary assessments and all this sort of other stuff, that the behavior of the pig through the gas stunning is a sort of neurological sort of reaction to gas. And so I suppose you could almost relate it to, the guys that are condemned to death by, you know, by gas and all that sort of stuff, you know, and in human terms, it's still highly contentious, particularly in America, and different ways they euthanize people that have been sentenced to death, all this other stuff. So my guess is that the authorities are unlikely to head off in that area of banning gas stunning. I think they're more likely to see how, you know, the whole thing develops over the coming years. So in terms of welfare, I don't think the welfare argument against gas stunning has actually fattened too much purchase, if you like, with the authorities. Is that a fair assessment in your eyes?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think especially with the authorities or both processors and farmers are on some of these boards, I think when people talk about welfare, it needs to be we either really care about the animal or we don't, because we can't care halfway. Like, my view on the non-stunt slaughter is that even if I had beef animals or we've got goats and sheep, I wouldn't sell my animals anywhere that they're not getting stunt. Because my argument is this: being brought up religious, I understand the religious side, but I don't understand how, as a species, as humans, we can look after an animal for 2 years if it's a cow, or 6 months for a sheep or a goat or whatever, and you can't spend 10 seconds to kill it in a way that it doesn't put it through pain. I don't know how we can't do that.
Yeah, so I've obviously got a number of vets that work for me. And the veterinary profession are fundamentally against non-stunt. Okay, yeah. So from an organizational point of view, we represent people that comply with the law.
Mm-hmm.
So if the regulators want to change the law to ban non-stunning, that is for them to do. We can't step into that space.
No.
And suddenly become arbiters of how animals are stunned.
Yeah.
So we did offer an option to DEFRA, funnily enough, 5-6 years ago, which was the exponential increase in non-stunning has mainly been in halal.
Mm.
In terms of kosher slaughter, those numbers have been pretty static for the last 20, 30 years. But halal clearly has increased. And so with that, the demand for non-stunning. And the authorities, if I'm brutally honest, have never been brave enough to carry out what they want to do, which is to ban non-stunning.
Mm.
So if they're not prepared to ban it, then there are alternatives that would benefit welfare. And the obvious one is a post-cut stunt. So if you take sheep, for instance, opposed to a cut electrical stud, you know, the throat is cut and there's an immediate electrical form. So it's instant. In the case of cattle, for non-stone, you would cut the throat and you would have a captive bolt immediately. Poof. Mm. That's it. So the suffering would be over in a fraction of a second.
Mm.
At the time, in terms of the sheep, DEFRA said to us, we won't do that because everybody was then non-stone. And we said, well, that's complete nonsense because the retailers won't have it.
Yeah.
A significant proportion of the export countries won't have it. So you're talking nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got almost a consensus of people that think that non-stun should be banned. And we can all disagree or agree about that. But the authorities do no more than trying to limit the damage by making it more difficult and expensive to non-stun. But each time they attempt that, they have the opposite effect. And the classic example was the V-restrainer in sheep, where they decided that they would ban the V-restrainer, which is the best animal welfare piece of equipment that was developed in New Zealand 45 years ago. It's a fantastic piece of equipment. Wonderful. Because they go up there stressless, you know, in this piece there, and the animal is slaughtered at the top. And it slows the process down. And so we said to them, well, why don't you introduce this? You know, postcard stun, and they wouldn't do it. So what they did instead, they banned the V-restrainer in the non-stun plants. So we said, well, if you do that, they're just going to go back to chasing sheep around the pens and up into races and increase the stress.
Mm.
And we said what they did. And we met with the officials. And they just didn't understand the issue. And when our senior vet, who's a barrister as well, said, look, this will, your decision to ban the virus trainer will actually make welfare immeasurably worse. The guy was that arrogant. He said, well, that's your opinion. He wasn't even a vet. And about 6 months later, he was invited to one of the larger stone plants where they were still using the virus trainer. And he was taken into the area, and there were three of these restrainers there with sheep going up. And he looked at that and said, oh, what a marvelous machine is that? He said, what is that? Oh, he said, it's a V-restrainer. Which you can do. I mean, I joke not. And so those plants that were doing 250, 300 an hour, which is lower rates, that had the V-restrainers, then had to take them out. And those same plants now doing 400 an hour. So it had exactly the opposite effect in terms of welfare than the one we proposed. So the debate around whether it's gas stunning, non-stunning, post-gas stunning, it's so highly charged that trying to get a minister to put his neck out and make a decision to do one thing or the other. It's not going to happen. And don't get me wrong. It's been tried and tried and tried. And, interestingly, the demand for non-stun, particularly in the sheep industry, when sheep went extremely expensive, in the retail, butcher shops, etc., which are many, they became much more accustomed to using stone. So there's been quite an increase, particularly over the last 2 or 3 years, in butcher shops that used to insist on non-stone actually having stone. Obviously, the halal sector in beef has increased enormously into a very high-value premium market. With big, strong bulls, 700, 800, 900 kilo bulls, hard-fed bulls going into the halal sector. And these are animals up to, say, 500 kilos dead, which obviously would not meet any supermarket spec. And they're at a premium price. So there's almost a separate industry reinvented over the last 5-6 years of strong, big-weighted animals, which really were off the supermarkets back and therefore worthless. Now they're back in the premium market. So it's common.
It's definitely worth pointing out. I think we had AWOL on from HDB, and I think it's something that the farming industry really needs to outline the opportunities in that halal sector, and I think a lot of sheep farmers especially would be quite surprised at the amount that the halal sector are buying.
It's not just the domestic market. We have a strange situation where, in terms of getting export health certificates for exports, we've got a whole list of countries where we can sell sheep meat, whether it's stinged or non-stinged. And if you take the Gulf states, a lot of the Gulf states take stunned as well as non-stunned. But in terms of new markets like Indonesia, DEFRA are now refusing to issue any more health certificates, and have been since George Eustace was there, to any more halal markets. So we said to them, well, why don't you issue the health certificates for animals that have been stunned to countries where we know, like Indonesia, like Dubai, and these other Gulf states that do accept stunned animals? No, we're not going to do it. So we're wasting a huge... we take to Indonesia, I think you guys know better than me, it's like 120 million citizens live there, mainly halal Muslim. And a lot of that market will accept stunned, but we can't access it because Jeffrey won't give us health certificates. Whole thing's crackers.
Yeah, I think government support is and hopefully now with the new government, hopefully things change and we get more support. One thing I definitely wanted to touch on was, and one thing we've discussed on a previous episode of the pod is, and a big issue for farmers and processors is third party audits. And really the plethora of them that we have as farmers or as processors, and extra costs in the supply chain. And yeah, really, Norman, I've seen a couple of articles you've done sort of summarising this and your thoughts from an AIMS point of view. I just ask you to sort of sum up the third party audit scheme as we have it now, and what could be the solution to take out costs for farmers and processors.
So my criticism, which has been portrayed in the press, is purely on Red Tractor. It's nothing to do with Red Tractor. It's to do with third-party audit per se, which, quite frankly, doesn't do what it says on the tin. It doesn't protect the retailers from animal welfare exposés. And there are quite a number of retailers that have lost confidence in Red Tractors as an example or audit. So they've turned to their own audits. So you've got Red Tractor, then you've got some of the ones that have their own on-farm audits as well, etc. Even set up their own platforms, like Morrison's did with Authenticate. And so the latest argument over the environmental element that Red Tractor were wanting to impose was just the end of a long line of dissatisfaction. And more and more third-party audit streams were getting involved. I mean, some of these large processes could have 6, 8, 10, 12 audits a week, and they're all ticking the same boxes. And the great thing about third-party audit is that if you look at all the food scandals of the last 10, 15 years, they've missed everyone. Not one of them, all of them. So if you take the Losco Foods scandal 12 months ago, Local Authority missed it, Food Standardization missed it, BRC missed it, Red Tractor missed it. Fine. So for all the costs that those bodies enforce upon the industry, what was the industry getting back? What was the retailer getting back? What was the consumer getting back? What was the farmer getting back? I'd say bugger all. Nothing. So I go back to what a guy called Bill Jolly said. who's the head of this whole thing in New Zealand. Now, New Zealand depend 95% on exports. So they have to comply with the requirements of every international market to trade. And Bill is a wonderful guy. He was speaking at the World Food Congress in Tokyo in 2019. And he'd be sat there, there'd be 250 representatives of the big, you know, multinational audit companies this Saturday, who were totally immersed in third-party audit. And his statement was most interesting. He said, look, he said, third-party audit is nothing more than a money-making scam that should be confined to the dustbins of history. What you require is a competent authority audit with suitable penalties, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a damning assessment by the one nation in the world that pretty well can only exist on exports. So we've had no solution over here on this side of the water, because the idea of farm to fork has been talked about for 25 years, but it's never been delivered in actual, you know, measurable stuff that people can relate to. You know, you get Red Tractor, you get all these other ones, you know, RSPCA assured, and they have their inspection. But it doesn't deliver true traceability. It doesn't deliver the farm to fork ethos. It delivers a mishmash of audit individuals who've got variable competence and everything else that goes with it. So what's changed over the last 18 months is the launch of the Animal Health and Pathway Review on farm. And if you remember what Bill Jolly said, what you require is a strong, competent authority audit. So here's the story. The Animal Health and Pathway Review is DEFRA funded. The vet, when he does that pathway review on farm, is working for and paid for by DEFRA. So that element of the review morphs into a competent authority audit, which in world trade terms is worth 100 third-party audits. And when I put it to the New Zealanders, this is the path we're off down to, they said, we can only aspire to that. So my question was, when was the last time you heard the New Zealanders or the Aussies saying they would aspire to something that we're doing here in England?
Oh, definitely.
And I articulated that in a World Food Integrity Conference last November, which Chris Elliott ran in London. And that's what set forward the whole debate about how we embrace this and use it. If farmers are having a competent authority audited on their farm, paid for by DEFRA, why wouldn't you use it? What is the logic of not using that wonderful piece of work? So if you put together that with livestock information for real-time movement data, which we've got in sheep and we'll have in cattle in the next 12 months or so, and we can introduce pigs, we can introduce any species, that then keeps the CVO happy in the case of a disease outbreak. Foot and mouth. She knows, different to 2001, she would then know where the bloody hell the livestock's been and where it is. There is your basic assurance. That's it. So what we did when we started to launch our ideas on this was we did a gap analysis on a full Red Tractor audit. Chris has seen this. And we included all of the functions of the audit on the right-hand side. We divided those up between what would be covered by the Animal Health and Pathway Review. Then our vets transferred over a rake of other stuff like medicines and whatever you want, that the vet could then stay on farm for an extra couple of hours at the expense of the farmer to validate another great big chunk of what the Red Tractor Review or the animal, you know, or the RSPCA would do. Although, say that may cost the farmer 150 quid, that is a fraction of what it would cost for his Red Tractor audit. which is 600 quid. So you shift that stuff over. And this, by the way, will all be on an app, which your farmer just has the app. All the stuff goes in there. Everybody has access. You give access to your processor customer. And there's all the information. It's all in one place. So the stuff that goes then left on the right-hand side could all be done electronically, remotely, the lot.
So all of it. Am I right in thinking your own vet can do this, your own farm vet?
Yeah, because your own farm vet is doing the pathway review.
Which makes it more comfortable.
Yeah, so he's paid for by DEFRA to do that.
Yeah.
To do that bit, he's working for DEFRA. And he's therefore got the responsibility under his RCVS, you know, duties to do what is right. And therefore, he then stays on at the farmer's expense to do the other stuff. And then all the rest we do electronically, the whole damn lot. So all of a sudden, you've got everything that essentially the retailers require through Red Tractor and through RSPCA, all over and all done, all dealt with. So once you've put that lot together, the beauty of it is the retailers and the processors can pick and mix, because there's a lot of stuff in Red Tractor at the minute that quite a lot of retailers wouldn't be interested in. So they don't have to have it. So you as a farmer can give your customer just exactly what he wants. And for instance, if they turn around and say, right, we want to, on the same app, we want your carbon measurements and all this sort of other stuff, which is going to sit elsewhere, we make it accessible through the app, the whole thing.
Yeah, well, I do think there's a lot of the staunch sort of Red Tractor supporters, and I think there is some good parts of Red Tractor. I think it's worked well in the poultry meat industry, but I think, look, just if there's things to be improved, especially and in other third party orders, we've got to look at them, because we all know that farming is a tough job and the margins are tight. And with something like this, I think if we can remove cost from it, then it's a positive thing. What Flav, Neil, what do you think?
My little thought about it was, I think it sounds a brilliant idea. I think it's really good. But again, I think it just comes back to farmers really hate having all their information out there on the sort of general show, don't they? They like to keep things to themselves. It's a bit of an issue, isn't it? Sharing information. We were talking before we went on air recording this, myself and Chris and Flav, about, you know, farmers being open about profitability and how they run their farms, and farms are not. They're a real closed book and they like keeping this information themselves. And if you get everything on an app where anybody and everybody could just access that information and all of a sudden you cut everything out, it'd be a no-brainer. But I think the issue we've got is actually not the issue of having everything on an app. I don't think the app's the issue. I think it's probably farmers and getting them used to the idea and not realising that Big Brother's watching them.
So let me knock that head on the head straight away. The issue of whether your animal health and pathway review was successful will be a matter of public record. So the database in DEFRA will be in public. And it will say that Chris Dickinson had his pathway review on such and such. And that's that, yeah? So, if there is a case of enforcement on that holding, so I'll give you an example. The DEFRA have introduced a very sensible, risk-based, proportionate approach to enforcement. So initially, the vet would say to you, there's five or six things here that need to be dealt with over the next 3 months period. And if that period goes by and it hasn't been done, then you move to the next stage, et cetera, et cetera. So over a 12-month period, it would become obvious of whether the farmer was going to comply with what the vet required under DEFRA instructions. So there's three or four there's three or four moves before what I would call prosecution for welfare or whatever. So that process itself wouldn't be public. The only time anything would be public is if Chris Dickinson had his review taken away from him. But everybody would know that in any case, because there'd be a prosecution in court that Mr. Dickinson done this, that, and the other, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, so essentially, you'd lose your license to farm. So the actual pathway review itself is a marvellous opportunity to farmers to say, I've had my pathway review. Yeah, there was half a dozen things it needed doing. I shall see to those over the next 3 months.
Yeah.
So let's take it to the end point of risk, where there's an animal welfare expose to a farmer that has, through a processor, supplied Tesco's, Asda, Sainsbury, whoever. At that point, the vet that did the initial review would go back to the farm to establish the facts, et cetera, et cetera. So the retailer would be able to say, well, the vet's gone back there. The guy's either been struck off, or he's been prosecuted, or this, that, and the other, or the improvement's been put in place, et cetera. So you've got a very simple, automatic system of monitoring what's going on. Because if there is that catastrophic incident, which some activist has taken, the vet goes back and establishes the facts. 9 times out of 10, if the vet goes back there, on the evidence of some activist, 9 times out of 10 it'll be a load of rubbish. But you would have a simple process. Now, the other advantage of the system we're advocating is that for the last 10, 15 years, they talked about lifetime assurance.
Yeah.
Okay? Has it been delivered? No. This delivers it overnight. Because you've got the animal movement, you've got the pathway. So if you're somebody who's got 500 dairy cows and you've got 300 male calves to sell here, and you're a farm that's had the pathway review, you sell them to a variety of farms who've also had the pathway review. You might then sell them to a finisher that's also had a pathway review. There's your lifetime assurance. Delivered overnight. It gets better. Half of the sheep flock in the UK is not assured because they don't need it, because they've got exports, they've got halal. The retailers only use less than 20% of UK produced sheep meat. 80% goes elsewhere. So at a stroke, the other 50% of farms become assured overnight, lifetime assured. So in one stroke, you do what everybody else has failed to do in the last 10, 15 years. And at minimal cost to the producer. But here's the best thing. If you look at the average cost of, say, a red tractor audit, is it 600, 650 quid a farm?
Yeah.
So if you take off the extra 150 quid, we're saying, for the vet to stay on for a couple of hours to do the extra stuff, let's say there's 450 quid. You've got 16,000 farms. You've got 7.25 million quid saved. The average cost of the large processors of the whole third-party audit function that they've got to do, with a large process, you're talking of a minimum of $2.5 to $3 million a year. And that is to manage the whole assurance system, all the audits, all this, that, and the other.
Yeah. Flav, I'd just be interested to get your thoughts on it as a farmer and obviously with your and your processing background. What would you think for this as an alternative?
I think it sounds good, and I think like the point Neil makes that farmers, or as farmers, we don't like to share. I overshare sometimes about what happens on farms and mistakes, all sorts. Like I've shared when a sow's killed 10 piglets online and it ended up creating a good conversation. You're obviously going to get people that don't like it, but it shows people what actually happens behind the scenes. And I think something like a, having like a pathway thing that you say, how Norman says it's going to be like a public thing and it's out there. Let's say like something like Company's House, you can type in Neil's farm or Chris's farm, and you can see how the audit went or whatever. I think one, that would show the public how the openness farmers have, because if we're saying as farmers, Black British farmers, and yet we won't allow you on the farm unless we've had a little sweep up and made it all nice for you to see, why the hell should I back you if I don't trust you?
Yeah.
And I think we'd also have less exposés if everything is out there clean. For example, our farm here, what's someone coming to expose when they see it all on TikTok and Instagram all the time? And yeah, I think
that's a good point.
To me, as a farmer, yes, we're all human. No, like you can't walk into anyone's house and say you're not going to find a cobweb in a corner or a bit of dust somewhere or like a dog hair on, I don't know, on a kitchen counter or whatever. It's like we're all human. But there are things that would be unacceptable. Like if you were to turn up and there's an animal with a gaping wound with maggots coming out of it, that's not, or this has just happened. That's neglect. So there are things that all as farmers as a whole, we'd all say, actually, that's wrong. And good farmers shouldn't be tarnished by the same brush by having a few people that, for whatever reason, don't have best practices. So I think definitely I'd be on board on the openness of, as a consumer as well, like we're all consumers, I'd want to be confident in that. I'm buying goats from Chris, and I know that if I was to walk on that farm when Chris is not there, I'm not going to find a goat that got its foot caught on a barrier 3 days ago and is still there bleating, like there's no tomorrow, legs lost circulation and all sorts. And any farmer that's negating that, well, let's have a discussion why, what have you got to hide? Because if all farms were open door policy, yes, I know we've got issues with crime, like we've got a friend in Cumbria that constantly has people breaking in and stuff. But if farms had the open door policy, you can turn up at a gate and a farmer shows you around, I don't think people wouldn't have any reason to expose. There's nothing to expose because it's there to be seen. So that, yeah, that's my view on that.
Yeah.
So I would just finish with a comment. We're looking here, if you look at just farmers and processors, you're looking at a cost saving for the industry, 50 to 60 million. That is without
the
cost of compliance units within the retailers themselves.
Yeah.
My guess is that we're talking of 60 or 80 million taken out of cost to the chain. So the question then is, there would be some concern that the retailers would walk off from that and the farmers wouldn't get any benefit. Well, the answer is all you need to do is just say, look, how much, you know, if you said to AHDB as an example, right, here's 50 or 60 million to invest back in for the levy, what would you do with it? All of a sudden, you save that sort of money, you've got a pot of money to help in areas which AHDB and others haven't been able to do because they didn't have the money. So that 50 or 60 million is disappearing down the tubes. For what? It doesn't do what it says on the tin. And that's what we need to get away from. We need to embrace technology and everything else we can do with this stuff. I mean, for instance, if you take the BRC element, which we haven't talked about, we've looked at the BRC audit, and we're not going to fall out with the BRC about this. It's a matter between the retailer and the BRC. But everything that BRC do can be done electronically. It doesn't need site visits. All they need to have is access to the data. And then if they see something trending wrong, they just send an unannounced audit into a meat plant to find out what's going on. Every other industry does this. They, you know, BRC could do a huge streamlining of what they're doing. And so the only people that are going to be chased off about this initiative are the third-party audit companies. And quite frankly, I couldn't give a monkeys.
Still talking as ever, Noel. I think one other question I think we've chatted about on the pod before is just and I know me and Flav have both been affected by this, is the amount of closures of small abattoirs. Obviously, as farmers, we constantly go to different events and we're told to diversify and A lot of farmers look to start their own brand, whether it's sheep or pigs or goats or beef or whatever. And obviously small abattoirs are a great way of local being able to supply local food. We've obviously seen quite a lot of these close. I just wondered what you sort of thought were the main reasons for this, and is there anything, what could be done to negate this?
It's a complex story. It is true that over the last 5 or 6 years, we've probably lost 30 or 35 abattoirs in totality. Quite a lot of those abattoirs that were shut are still in business, not the abattoirs. They've shut the abattoir, and they could have converted the abattoir into a shop, they could have converted into a cutting operation, and they could then get their stuff contracts loaded down the road. So the numerical number is quite misleading. The other thing which is misleading is that if you take the micro abattoirs from 14 years ago, when they took away the 20 units, in those days, you could do 20 units a week, cattle units equivalent, but you had to use the square stand, so you couldn't export. So FSA took that took that restriction off quite sensibly. So what that then meant was abattoirs which had just been doing 20 units on one day a week, they could do two days a week, 3 days a week, as much as they want, relative to the chilling capacity they had. And so what you've seen is you have seen a number of plants numerically drop, but they've been sucked up by what were microabattoirs expanding into contract slaughter and doing miles more than what they used to. So if you listen to the protagonists about it, they say that because the number of abattoirs have shut, that means there's less livestock going through small abattoirs. It isn't true. The number of livestock numerically going through the remaining clutch of small abattoirs, which are provided the contract slaughtering, has gone through the roof. So I can go straight to one example down in the southwest where they built a small abattoir. Because of the restriction, it was doing 20 units a week. That abattoir now is doing 120 units a week, all contract slaughter, doesn't sell an ounce of meat. It's got a cutting operation. It's got a packing operation. So Flavio or Chris or anybody else who's living in that area can go in there, have an animal slaughtered, have it chilled over 2-3 weeks, have it cut up, have it packaged in their own, lane, whatever it is. All they then need is a half a ton chili wagon. They've got a meat business. And they haven't done anything.
Yeah.
So, yes, there are one or two areas of England in particular where, in an ideal world, there would be another small abattoir. But there's a reason they're not there, because they weren't commercial. They wouldn't use them, or they just wanted to use the big boys, which is fine. I understand all that. So, but we've mapped it, and so have DEFRA. And this is why they have come up with a couple of initiatives now to support small abattoirs. You know, we feel it was far better to support the expansion and the services of the existing small abattoir group, ones around the country. Make them do more, help them do more, help them into exports, whatever you like. Because the history of building new abattoirs, especially ones that have been done by farmer cooperatives, to say that it's mixed, or I could be even more specific and say, without exception, they don't bloody well work. In fact, one of the only successful farmer groups that have maintained abattoirs and expanded probably is Farmers Fresh. Yeah. Now, there aren't many that have actually done it. So, definitely have moved in our direction. But when a group of farmers come to me and tell me they want to build an abattoir, I'm quite happy to talk. Great. So what's your proposition? And if they were to stick to contract slaughter, and they can demonstrate that they've got enough capacity to do that for the people that are slaughtering to then take the carcasses away and sell to the kazoo or whatever they want to do, or they've got their own cutting plan, that's fine. But 9 times out of 10, they say, oh, we're going to get into meat wholesaling. Well, at that point, they're knackered. They take themselves into a completely different territory, which is highly competitive, highly specialized, price conscious and everything else. So you know, when farmers wanted it in Avatar, they were restricted to sorting, cutting, and packing for commercial customers that have their own meat businesses. That's great. But if they're going to get in there and get into meat wholesaling, you've only got to look at the Avatar up on Orkney and all these other places. It's going to be a disaster. So for me, the support that DEFRA have launched, and there's a second wave to come, probably won't build that many new avatars. If you build a handful, that'd be brilliant. But it would probably much more be directed to supporting the existing ones, expanding their successful operation. I mean, Chris, you've got one not far from you in the Lake District.
Ares. Yeah.
You know, Ares, another one not far from there. Ares was a small one. With a
great little business.
Yeah, a butcher shop and a micro avatar. So they shut the shop, turned that into a bigger shop, build a new small avatar in the existing building they have, do a marvellous job. They export stuff to Hong Kong every bloody week, for God's sake. So just to show what can be done in those small businesses. But he's never got into what I call, you know, competitive retail, you know, competitive wholesaling. It's specialist markets, and that works well. So I think that
I could see you have an abattoir, Flav, definitely.
Me opening an abattoir?
Yeah, I could just see it now.
Well, I would, but I don't think I've got the time to shoot that into my day.
If you want something, don't ask a busy man. That's what I say.
Exactly.
Yeah, so in terms of opening an abattoir,
before you get sort of talking about opening an avatar, and this question sort of just thinking of the question links in, is what are the big opportunities for the UK meat sector? Because that ties in quite nicely with opening an avatar and stuff like that. So what are the opportunities, you know, for the meat sector going forward, really? What do we need to do?
So in COVID changed everything with regard to sales, direct sales to the consumer. So I got 100 Cajun Butcher members, and the night the COVID broke, they're all shut down. Hospitality shut, everything. For them to survive, they had to change their business model. So they changed to selling direct to consumer, whether it was online, whatever. And I'll give you one example of one down in Leafy, Gloucestershire. And their customer base was high-class restaurants, high-class hotels, etc. Usual risk, 2 months credit, people are in bust, this and the other. Proper branding, Longhorn branding, superb quality stuff. And when hospitality was shut down, they said, well, what the hell are you doing now? So you get yourself a website, get on social media, get wherever, and sell direct to consumer. Home delivery, the whole damn lot. In 9 months, they changed their business model around to selling 100% direct to the consumer, every ounce of which was paid for before it left the factory. Every ounce. So instead of having a £500,000 overdraft, you had £500,000 in the bank.
Big difference, isn't it?
Huge. So a lot of that proposition of selling direct to the consumer has survived and prospered. Even the larger operators, even the big catering butchers that got into it. So one of the biggest members of ours, they had about 500-600 staff. They laid off 300 or 400. They had 200 left, and they did pop-up shops. They did every mortal thing just to keep the whole cash flow going. And they've obviously gone back into Wetherspoons and all those sorts of contracts, etc., which are price conscious. But they've kept on to that other business. So domestically, I think selling high-value product to the consumer is good. So the question is, can that allow that level of business to use the same story in exports? Well, of course it can. You know, no question. The expansion of halal, if the government will allow markets that are desperate for our product, is there. Australia, as you know, just banned live exports. They used to live exports to the Gulf states. So the Gulf states are going to have to get used to accepting carcasses from that part of the world. So there's huge opportunity for us there. I can see the Australian industry turning around and moving to, for those Gulf states that want non-stone slaughter, because obviously when they went to the Gulf states, there would be non-stone slaughter. So I can see the Australians, they're either going to have to allow their plants, or they kept they do already, to expand their non-stone slaughter, or the Gulf states will have to accept some. A lot of those Gulf states will. So I think we can expand over there. It's put Australia in a more awkward position than where it's been. And if you look at the welfare, some of the journey times for those big Australian ships with about 20,000 sheep on, it looks a bit of a challenge to say the very least. And again, in beef, you know, it's still the niche. You know, the farmers that access these processes that are developing these high value markets, you know, COVID did that a world of good. And, you know, do farmers need to become semi-processors themselves? Not necessarily. If they want to, the facilities are there to facilitate that. So halal is expanding, especially in beef. Exports to new markets, 110%. If DEFRA will open up a country like Indonesia, and that's for stunned. The pork sector is a bit more interesting. You know, as Fabio will know, it's more domestically controlled by the large processors, who incidentally probably own 40% of the production, primary production on farm anyway, might even be more. But is there a greater opportunity to facilitate premiumization of pork? Of course there is. It's a story. You know, it's Fabio's story about his, that's what he sells on. It's a story about how what he does with his live pigs and his product. Can that be expanded? Of course it can. And at this moment in time, there's enough slaughter capacity to facilitate any of that. It might not be. It's interesting. When we mapped it all out, there's nowhere in the country you can't get to an abattoir within 2 hours. Now, the fluffy people would turn around and say, well, that's too long. But it's tough because that's DEFRA's criteria.
Yeah.
Anything, you know, if it's within 2 hours, it fits DEFRA's definition of being welfare friendly or welfare compliant, call it what you like. So as long as that's the case, you can see why DEFRA haven't put a vast amount of money into building new abattoirs, because they fear that it'll be money down the drain, and most of it will probably run. Whereas supporting the existing network and expanding that is much more, you know, realistic.
I think it's interesting with the hearing that the 2 hour sort of limit that DEFRA have, because like today I was talking to some people that came on the farm about like the whole net zero and what I think net zero is. And I think we have policymakers that have all these targets and come out with all this nonsense about achieving certain things. But like on our farm, again, as an example, fairly small compared to some of the big operations, is that we source, I'd say, in a ration, 80%, 90% of our raw materials come from 3 miles away.
Yeah.
We do everything we can on the farm. I don't have a tractor, so I use my truck to do most of the stuff or just walk around and do it. But then when it comes to slaughter of the animal, all the bits that are saved on carbon and emissions and not using soya goes down the drain, because I've got to drive to Chippenham to go to the abattoir and back once a week.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where they're hoping for A and they're achieving J. The two things don't add up at all.
I think it's not it's not a 2 hour limit. It's their view. The journeys within 2 hours fit their idea of welfare friendly, if that's the best way, you know, to possibly put it. Because obviously You can't have a two-hour limit, because otherwise the stuff from Northern Scotland will never get slaughtered, you know, when it's 12 hours away. You know, you've got the current transport times during which, if it's longer, they have to, you know, stop and rest and this, that, and the other. The two-hour definition, if you like, is something which they consider fits their, not the legal requirement, but their sort of criteria about being acceptable. That's the best way to put it. They think that traveling 2 hours in terms of local production is a perfectly acceptable thing. And there's virtually nowhere within the country you can't get to an hour. Now, you might not be able to get to the abattoir that you want, but then you're into commercial stuff then, you know, it gets over complex.
No, that's great. That's sort of brings us to a close on this episode. But yeah, I think it was great. Thank you, Norman, for sharing that with us, and I look forward to hearing about Ames's vision for third party audits. And I think as all farmers and processors would agree, if we can take some cost out of the supply chain, it would be great. I think, yeah, it's great to have someone like you on, Norman, with your knowledge and passion for the industry. And if we've got people at the helm, then I think the industry is in a good, safe place. So thank you for joining us. That's it for tonight. But we will be back in the coming weeks. We've got some other very exciting guests. So on behalf of myself, Flav, and Neil, thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thank you. Cheers, Norman. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Norman.
Thanks. Bye. Right, and that brings to end another episode of the Three Prong Podcast. And, yeah, a very informative episode, I think we'll all agree, on a key issue, which I think is going to be very topical for farmers and processors going forward. Yeah, some of the numbers Norman mentioned that we could save in the supply chain, I think, yeah, would really grab people's attention. So, yeah, it's definitely going to be one to watch and monitor over the next few months about where it goes. Like you said, if that's what New Zealand are sort of aiming for, it's very, very rare as UK farmers that, we're ahead of them. So let's hope we can be, and let's hope we can things can improve for the better.
Definitely. I was just struck by the man's knowledge. I always imagine when we get these people on it and they just spew out these facts and figures, and his passion for it is really clear, to have that much knowledge just there. And like you say, you know, I think UK agriculture just needs to be a lot more open. It comes down to the whole thing about being open, doesn't it? Because if we had all this stuff there available, it would save a lot of time and effort and hassle and stress as well, because no one enjoys doing a red tractor audit. And if we can take some of that out of it, that's going to reduce a huge amount of stress in farmers' lives.
Yeah, I think that as much as a lot of farmers are fairly, like, quite, the mention of assurance schemes always raises people's, is it heckles or hackles? Whichever one it is. I think the system Norman was talking about there, it would definitely be more attractive than unattractive. And I think for me, the biggest thing I picked up on is that transparency. Like we all, like I said earlier, we always talk about back British farming, but we need to give people reason to back British farming, not just because we're local, because that's not enough.
Yeah, 100% agree. Well, thanks again for listening. And don't forget to like and subscribe to Spotify, us on Spotify and Apple iTunes. And yeah, we look forward to seeing you again in the future.